Who said that? Hark! Hark, do I hear voices?
Who could it be?
Who could it be? Is it Mary Flanagan and Sam Roberts?
Hi, Trin.
Hi, Luke.
We think you two would get along.
Yeah, I mean, I get along great with Mary.
That remains to be seen. Let's start the show.
Welcome to I Think You Two Would Get Along. It is the podcast that comes out of the Kickstarter games team, and it is a hour-long conversation that two nerds, me and Luke, try to have with two other nerds. This week, we've got Mary Flanagan of Mechanica, Sam Roberts of Indiecade, and you did a RPG zine about playing football to put inside of RPG games.
Yes, I did.
Luke, would you give a little intro of Mary, and then Mary can correct it?
Mary Flanagan is an educator, a researcher, and game designer working with, I believe her game design company is Resonym. She teaches at Dartmouth. So you've got a lot going on, Mary.
I also have a Kickstarter going on right now, and I'm very pleased about that.
I was gonna mention that. Tell us about your Kickstarter, Mechanica. I love the art.
Yay! It's another one of our subversive little games from Resonym. Mechanica actually was conceived as a game about chocolate factories, but we couldn't deny that the impending AI revolution slash dystopian turn was just around the corner. And so we realized after an article in a major daily newspaper about Roombas taking over and being able to map the interior of your house and listen to you, that maybe it's time that humans were actually in service of the Roombas themselves. So Mechanica is about a robot revolution, but the robots are helpful vacuum cleaners with a little bit of a diabolical twist.
So quick question, just for people who may have a robot vacuum because they have too many cats.
It depends on your model, but some of them are building a virtual map of your house and using it for pathfinding. I have a friend whose Roomba texts her every time it's completed a circuit or when it runs into a problem. She has given it the name Boyfriend in her phone. Very useful. But perhaps one of those steps towards the robot revolution that we have not been.
It's just time that we work for them, really.
Yeah. They would do a better job.
That's correct.
The mechanism for the game, Mary, is bonkers. The whole, the puzzle piece, the turning of the whole board and whatnot, like, or the, you know, where you're dropping stuff in the, like, it's a little factory thing. Like, it's very cool.
You guys who are listening to the show can't see this, but Mary just, like, held up pieces from her game and, like, all of our eyes got very wide, and it's very exciting. I also love that it's instant setup. Like, when I read the whole thing, like,
yeah,
the
look at
intro.
Look at that. Oh, my God. Sorry.
She's putting things in stuff. It's very exciting.
The components. Component quality is
like
great.
Watching a science experiment.
Check out the Kickstarter project at www.kickstarter.com.
Yeah, do the whole thing. Say the whole thing.
MechanicaGame.com.
If you Google Mary Flanagan and Mechanica, you'll probably find it.
Maybe.
You can just go to MechanicaGame.com because we'd redirect to our Kickstarter page right now.
That's a very good move. Before,
yes, for those listening at home, that's a professional level skill that a game designer who wants to be releasing great work should have.
To be able to redirect to websites?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You'd be surprised how many Kickstarter projects are not set up that way. For instance, my Kickstarter project has no homepage. And were you to try Googling it, I don't even know if you would find the project.
This might surprise you, Sam, but that does not surprise me that this is not a common skill. Luke, if you could do your best stab at introing Sam Roberts, our friend here, that would be wonderful because we've been ignoring him.
Yeah. From what I understand, my friend Sam Roberts is also an educator at USC and a game designer, a many storied game designer. He is also an organizer, being one of the organizers for a very well regarded collection of or indie games festival called Indiecade, and he is an ever flowing font of salty football knowledge.
Salty.
Salty. It doesn't come in the unsalted variety.
Like petty? Like you've got petty, like salty knowledge? Like you've got shade to throw?
Oh, lots of shade to throw. I mean, let's be clear. For anyone who is unaware, most professional sports get a huge amount of their sort of like narrative audience value from essentially as soap opera machines. They're procedural generators for soap opera. And that creates plenty of opportunities for shade to be thrown. Plus, there's a lot of baked in tribalism, which, you know, has some issues, I guess, but certainly makes people easy to come up with salt again to throw. Of course, if you're throwing salt, it's really only harmful if you're throwing it at slugs. Is that correct?
If you throw it over your shoulder, it's actually a pretty good idea. I'm just saying.
Yeah. Directly into someone's eyes.
Aren't the riot guns made with huge salt bags that they shoot at people, though? The anti-riot?
Sometimes. Like the police force?
On the rioters?
Sometimes.
Okay. That was a dark angle. I didn't need to go there. I was thinking about how to throw salt.
What's going on, Sam?
I was thinking about how to throw salt.
You know, I mean, like, this is probably going to be cut from the podcast, but I feel like all four of us are fairly, like, you know, non-police officers. I don't know how else to say that. Oh, no. What is she pulling up?
To like, be the rule master all the time.
Oh, for...
Yeah, I mean, I would actually say on some level... Luke and I also are police. Luke helps police what goes on to kick. No, I guess you don't, do you?
No.
Let's just leave this track.
We shouldn't put this in the podcast. I'm just okay.
I'm cutting the entire past 15 minutes. Don't worry. Like, we're good.
Like, I told you, this is what I was trying to say again. At the end of the podcast, you're going to have like 30 minutes of useful shit Mary said and nothing left from me.
So like, but the way that the podcast usually goes like every week is like we have like these real questions that we want to like ask people, and then like what actually ends up being the most interesting to listen to is like us goofing around and talking about our salty football players. So you guys are both educators and you're both games people. How that seems like a lot of time. That seems like having a full-time job as a teacher, because teachers do more than other professions. You got to like grade papers and stuff, and you got to like make class curriculums and stuff. How do you do that? Let's start with Sam, because you're not chewing.
I mean, I'll be frank. This comes up a lot, but I work really hard. I don't know. I mean, that sounds almost like I'm complaining to say, but no, I work a lot of jobs. I think part of it, and maybe we have some younger listeners that are relating to this, because I hear this a lot, right? But we live in an American economy now where you're expected to have multiple jobs. And then I think games in particular is a field where there's a ton of stuff going on. And even now, but certainly 10, 15, 20 years ago, almost no one was doing any of it.
Yeah.
So you sort of had to do all of the stuff yourself, right? Like, I'm going to speak for Mary and then she can correct me. But like, if you are someone who is interested in doing academic research around play and how play can educate people and change their outlook, or about you gathering data on play to see how people react to other people and how they're acculturized, right? 10 years ago, if you wanted to do that, you not only had to be the game designer who made the game and the publicist who got the game out there so people could play it and the researcher who ran the test and the academic who wrote the paper. You know what I mean? Like, you had to vertically integrate the monopoly or you did not get to do the thing. And I'd love to hear actually what Mary has to say about it.
Did something change? Because I still feel like you have to do all those things. You're telling me I don't have to do all of that? That's awesome. No, I think that, yeah, I'd agree with Sam. Most of us are doing multiple things. I mean, most of the people I meet at game cons are definitely, have day jobs in CS and make their board games at night or whatever it is, or information engineers. I just think it's really, it's kind of a rare luxury to think that you can sit around and design board games all day. And there are some people who do that, but most of us are doing it and that's fine. I think that that's great because it means that our games get richer because we bring the rest of the world into our games. And we take our interests and let that influence board game mechanics and board game themes and really expand what they can do So I actually like, you know, going to an art museum, enjoying the art, and then going, ah, you know, I wonder what how a game would fit into this kind of idea. And I don't, it's not like I'm living the world in an applied fashion, but I just think the more that we're up to living and thinking about, the more, the richer our games will be.
So all I know from what Luke said is that you're both educators. So I'm assuming you have classes that you teach, or that head shake, Mary, what's different about, so you're not like a professor?
Yes, I'm a Uber professor.
Mary is a fully promoted with an endowed chair, fancy pants professor. In fact, we should be calling you Dr. Flanagan on this call.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's awesome. Can I do it? I mean, it seems that it embarrasses you a little bit. Is it okay if I call you Dr. Flanagan anyway, because that rules?
No, yes, it is true that I'm a doctor and a mad scientist, but I also think
Dr. Flanagan.
I don't know, there's been a lot of people in game design who come from a variety of backgrounds. I'm not unique in that. So I tend to think, you know, I teach game design, but I also teach new media art. I teach all kinds of stuff, and that's only part of what I do. I think that as soon as someone's associated with academics, they kind of lump you into being an academic, and it kind of means you're not a real designer. And so I reject the whole, like, mm-hmm. I reject that. And I don't really identify. I'm a teacher. I think I'm a pretty good teacher, but I don't like to identify in the kind of rarefied world of academia. I actually make things that real people play and read.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's awesome.
It is.
Sam, do you like identify as educator, as teacher? Like, what are some words that you would?
No. I mean, I that's interesting. First I will say, here at USC, actually, all of our faculty, we look for people who do what Mary does, who actually make games. So I also reject the supposition that to be involved in academy and education of games means you are no longer a game designer. I actually would reject it across most mediums. I think working professionals, particularly in the arts, are the best people to teach other people how to become working professionals in the arts. I am an academic administrator for my, for lack of a better word, day job. So I do a massive amount of curriculum development and community development and working with faculty to create a space where young people can come and learn about game design. I do teach, but teaching's a more limited part of what I do there. And primarily I teach tabletop role-playing game design because I love it more than all things because it is the warmest part of my heart.
Oh!
So wait. All right. So I also just started teaching.
Yeah.
I know.
And so I'm not an educator. In fact, I had a problem recently, and I had to go to the like department administrators, and I, like the first thing I said was like, I am not a teacher. I have no idea what I'm doing. Like, they just threw me into this class. That's actually one of the things that's really remarkable about teaching. I'm also teaching tabletop role-playing game design, and I know, and I've talked to Sam about his course, but that there's no curriculum for this. There's, right, I am someone who has done this for 15 years or something, and so I have a way that I have kind of managed to cobble together this path to, like, I kind of made a game. But, like, breaking that process down and turning it over into, like a way to think about making a particular type of game is terrifying. Like, I'm 4 weeks into my class right now, and I have no idea if they're learning anything at all.
No, I mean, I will jump in, and I want to plus up what Mary said before, and then I'd love to hear what she has to say about this. But I actually have discovered, particularly in the tabletop role-playing class I've now been teaching for several years, that as someone who makes things, having to sit down and figure out how to teach someone else how to make things makes you deeply question and understand your own process in a way that makes you a better maker or designer. So, like, I feel like I'm a better game designer after having had to teach people how to design games than I was before.
That makes sense, because it's almost like the difference between, like, making a game and, like, writing the instructions for the game. It's like, now I have to process this in a completely different way for an outsider, so it kind of changes your perspective. That's rad. It sounds like all of you were kind of like thrown into a classroom of wolves and they're like, go.
No one trained.
Faculty members in any field, in no field are faculty members trained to be teachers. That's for K through 12. There is no such thing as teaching for professors. Every professor anyone's ever had has figured it out.
Yep.
Wow. And that's kind of a gamer mentality. So it's kind of funny.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, people are thrown into a situation and they're like, all right, let me try this. I'll figure this out. Oh, there's a system of rewards. Oh, there's an end of class. There are these grades. I've got levels. You know, I mean, it's a
and curriculum design is iterative. You teach a class and then you go back and you didn't do it great and you try it again, just the way you do when you iteratively design a game project, right? I'd say the best situations here at USC, if somebody's starting to teach here, we give them a class with a set curriculum where they work with other faculty who have taught before so that they can get a sense of how we teach here. But even that, like, is the most you can do and doesn't help you teach anywhere else. So I don't know what you can do.
My mom's a teacher. She's been a teacher, an educator her whole life in like a variety of different ways. She's taught everywhere from prisons to like corporate offices to high school students, which is probably the hardest of all those things. But basically, you know, my mom stalks my classroom. Like, in, you know, I'm like turning around like, wait, did I do that wrong? Like, I feel this, you know, this pressure in my blood to teach the chillins correctly.
I understand that. Do you share ideas with other games teachers? Do you get like anything out of like meeting up and with that? Are there games teacher conferences?
Yeah, I mean, there's a Game Developers Conference, which is in the digital context. There's a educators forum, and there's some panels and stuff on teaching game design. I remember a pretty great one on teaching analog game design a while back, so that was really good. A lot of people who are involved in both digital and non-digital games shared top secret stuff. I think it also is about one's creative methodology, and thank goodness we do have different creative methodologies. When I have seen other people's game design syllabi, my heart cries often, because they're often built on creating powerful characters that can do battles. And in my class, I don't focus on battle stuff. I do kind of lots of different approaches to think about competition. I question reward structures. I have them experiment with physicality. And so I take it on a kind of I'm not trying to fit them into any particular kind of genre. I'm thinking about games and play as a really basic thing. Mm-hmm. And so there's a very different, that's very different than like, you know, rolling for character stats, and you have to build a different character with different stats. That's often a common trope in game design classes, to build, you know, you get a character sheet and you have to build it. And I kind of move away from that kind of thing. And someone else can move toward that kind of thing. I mean, that's why it's interesting. And I'm glad that there isn't a kind of consistent education for game designers, because there are standards to be met, but there are also these like creative practices. And a common question I get asked when I go to a board gaming event, so you a system designer first or content first designer? And I always find this a really weird question, because if I say, well, I like systems, clearly, but I really like content, they're like, yeah, I knew it. as though it's like this kind of like, hazing.
Yeah.
It's a hazing thing that, you know, the real game designers are systems people who make really great systems, and the content could be anything. You know, but people love things for a variety of reasons. So it's really, for me, great to kind of challenge those norms whenever.
It's so strange
I can.
That there's even like a certain amount of gatekeeping in what you got. It got you into game design. Systems is the more cool and strong and logical way to do things. Like, that seems so like masculinist. Is that, am I reading this right?
Probably. I'm gonna actually take this, jump in front of the bullet, as it were. I would say that certainly a large number of the people I know with that attitude are men. And that certainly in my experience at years and years and years and years of festivals, it is mostly women I see being questioned for their ability to do systems design, which certainly feels like inappropriately masculine attitude.
Yeah.
But I want to jump out here and real quick say, also think one of the things Mary's talking about is teaching lots of different approaches and having a non-prejudiced approach towards other approaches. And I actually think that this is the best way to teach most artistic things in general. My background is in theater. I studied theater. I did 10 years of professional theater in Los Angeles. Gotta love the plays, right? But theater in America has a very serious problem, which is that a huge amount of it is taught essentially as though there was one way to act. And that is... the Stella Adler School, Sandy Meisner, like, anything I say is going to make somebody angry about it. So I will leave it there.
I mean, that's true about everything on a podcast in general. Yeah, if you say something out loud on the internet, someone's going to be mad. So bring it on, all of it.
I think that there is a strong desire among people who teach things, who make things, to say this is the way and this is how things are done. Because then they can feel like they have the skill and they've mastered it and they are good. And people who don't have that skill don't really know what they're doing. And there's a bunch of human needs for expertise and separation that are fed by this. But the fact of the matter is, if you want to be a strong artist who can do a lot of things and make a lot of things about a variety of things, what you need is a tool kit. You need a lot of tools, because sometimes it is a screw that you're trying to put in the wall, and if all you have is a hammer, you will mess up the wall and the screw and nothing will work, right? And so when I was a stage director, I was constantly frustrated by actors who would come in and I'd be like, okay, we're doing something that's sort of like fantastical. Like, you're a wolf man and you're a fairy. And then the person's like, how do I as if that? And I'm like, you can't as if that because you've never been a fairy. So let's come up with a different thing we could try, maybe. You know, and as a game designer, you need to be able to do that too. And when I'm teaching young game designers, just like Mary has implied, what I try to do is present them with a lot, as much, here's my toolkit. Try to learn my toolkit, understand how I use it, see how it works for you. Adapt the tool if you need to. Go and learn somebody else's tools as well. Find the tools that are your tools and understand that everybody's tools are unique to them and you might have to adjust it a little. I gave this mini lecture in class the other day, but it's like, I can show you how to use a hammer, but if I'm right-handed and you're left-handed, you need to be able to transpose at least that to use the hammer right. If you just do exactly what I do, you will be using the hammer in your right hand, even though you are left-handed, and it won't work very well. Scissors. Somebody in class brought up scissors are designed for right-handed people, with the long loop and the short loop, and it's really difficult sometimes to use them as a left-handed person.
But Sam, I think one of the important points there is that you're teaching your skill set, your tool set. You're teaching your perspective, but with the recognition that there are others and that, like, you expect them to take this and adapt it and use it for their own needs.
I was going to say, which I feel like I have to do, because I don't want it to be an exclusive tool. I want them to have more tools, but I'm frankly not qualified to teach other people's tools, right?
Right.
If we can all have the attitude that, like, that's a little more tool agnostic, then we can also avoid the situation that Mary was describing and that Trin wondered if was very masculine, which I think probably is, at least as I said, circumstantially, it appears to be so. But I think it's related to this larger problem, right? That we are not tool agnostic, that we have a tendency to say, this is the right way to do it and the other ways are stupid.
Lady game designer, tell me about your world building.
That is the most commonly heard pickup line at GDC.
I believe it. Has anybody ever, like, walked into your classroom with just a really bad set of advice that they got? And you just had to be like, okay, I need to take down all of these really bad assumptions that you have. Is that something that occurs a lot? Do people have, like, really outlandish misconceptions on what it takes to be a game designer? Luke is nodding so hard. Why don't you start, Luke?
Well, just that, like, I don't know, from my perspective, and just kind of building on what we were kind of rambling about here, is just that that they ask me all sorts of, can I do this? Can I design a game like this? Or can I design a game like that? And of course, yes, you can, but not in this class. Not here, not now. Here and now, you're gonna design a game the way that I want you to design a game. And again, not in being completely prescriptive in terms of that this is the only way to design a game, but I'm actually trying to build a frame for them that they can then break later. So yeah, all their cockamamie ideas, like, you know, some of the students said like, oh, can you look at our, you know, our rough draft for our next exercise? And, you know, what I didn't tell them, because I'm going to kind of gotcha them, is that one, like, they pitched me two ideas and I, you know, I gave them feedback on both of them, but one of them isn't a role-playing game. Like, well, you know, I didn't say that to them.
Oh, and you, but you're teaching a class on role-playing games. So I'm it must specifically, be a role-play. There we go.
Yeah. So, but, you know, they, I mean, they need to come to that conclusion on their own in a way. Or I need to just jump out of a closet and go, bah! And scare.
Yeah, or maybe they need to make it in a way that's a role-playing game that you didn't know about. And
yeah.
Pull the wool back from Luke's eyes.
Yeah, maybe. But
occasionally. It happens.
It's exposing people to what's possible. Like, I take my students to Sleep No More, for example. Is that a game? Well, I don't really try to ask that question at first. I try to let every person figure out in what ways something is a game, what ways something isn't a game. I'm really interested in the more people are exposed to a variety of game-like things and playful maneuvers and rule-based systems, the more they can start to build their own voice. And so that's kind of how I take that. But the other thing that's really important to me when I teach game design is to talk about something that we don't have great words for as game designers, which is the sense of how you feel when you play. You know, we can talk about mechanics, we can talk about gameplay interactions, we can talk about chaining, we can talk about all kinds of things. But when, at the end of the day, when you kind of reflect upon the game and you're like, what kind of player was I? What did the game bring out in me? How do I feel about that? And like that aesthetics of play, like the play experience, the actual act of playing, like that is something that is real. It's really this ineffable kind of experiential embodied thing, yeah. Phenomenon that I try to get us to look at. How does it feel if you're playing a knockoff of Candyland, which is really a game about the French Revolution? It's a game of the goose that was built in 1791 and has still been published for 200 years.
What? This is new news to me.
Mary spent the last 2 years at the Getty, and she's gotten a little classical.
Wow.
Yeah, I get a little...
1640?
Yes, I get a little old school.
We gotta talk.
Is this your office? Is this your office, Mary, that you're in? This is your office? I just wanted to give some context for the listeners, because I do want to leave a lot of, like, your rumblings in, is that Mary's in her office, and every now and again she grabs something off the shelf and puts it in front of the camera, and it's really delightful, and I wish that this call could be video for everyone, but it won't be.
Well, people can just Skype and ask to see my office. That's got some really good stuff. I've got a whole history of playing cards from the just all anyway. Anyway, what I'm trying to say is this notion of the act of play, this aesthetic of play that we engage in, that we're trying to design for, that is the ultimate collection of our rules, our system, our mechanics, our interactions with each other, like that thing that's the golden nugget of the game is like the least talked about thing in game design. And so for me, that's the most important thing to try to get to in game design, is to look at that space, that dynamic, surprising space of that aesthetic experience of play, that phenomenon of embodied experience that we have together or alone, but sometimes together, at least in board games, and try to really kind of parse out how you can sculpt that as a game designer. What about certain rules and mechanics and systems and interactions actually get us to feel certain ways? And they're not, it's not as simple as like, well, in a co-op game, I'm always happy. You know, it's not that. It's not easy to reduce.
Well, I was just saying, we teach experience design. You know, like that's where we started. That's what I try to do in my class. And I have some tools that I try and give them for helping figure out how to define experience so that they can test against it. And those tools don't work for all my students. And I actually think we have a exactly as Mary says, there's a dearth of tools and vocabulary for discussing this central holistic piece of game design, right? This idea that like the users of this product have an experience that is defined by the different pieces of this product that you have made. And we, A, do not have a lot of fixed knowledge about how to provoke certain kinds of experience, and B, rarely frame our games experientially, particularly at the beginning, right? Experiential framing of games for the industry is a post-design marketing job, and it is an essential thing for a designer to be able to express themselves, I think, right? Again, like other people can make things differently. And I know there are people who throw paint on a canvas and then discover an experience that happens there, right? But I try to teach students to purposefully craft an experience out of the thing that they're making. And it's very hard to teach because we are really limited in the ways to talk about it. And very few people suggest that you start from there. Although Tracy does, I think. Tracy and Mary and Celia and some of the other members of Ludica. And if you go back in time, Bernie DeCoven, I think, began to give us a set of tools and playful experimentations and framings as to how we can think about game design as playful experience design.
I got a follow-up question, because I'm the one here who's not a game designer. Like I write for games, but I don't design them. So I want to make sure I'm understanding you all correctly. So the experience of the game, the thing that you feel when you're playing it that you're describing, is that something that you can set out to do, or is that emergent after you make a game and then you kind of like sculpt it from there?
Time will tell, but it's definitely emergent. But I do believe that there are certain kinds of decisions that you can put in a game that give the opportunity for players to make certain kinds of decisions that actually foster that kind of experience. Making choices that have different levels of speed in the play experience. For example, end game in a short game, long game, towards the end game. Details that matter, but matter in a way that kind of builds something that isn't just about conquering or victory. For me, it's the real suspect is power. The real suspect in a Foucauldian, Hegelian type of sense is power, and the manifestation of power that we kind of embody in games. The simplistic way to think about it is like, yes, I'm powerful. And the more sophisticated and more interesting way is, yes, I'm powerful, and I have certain wants and desires and human needs that actually have to be met somehow. And, you know, making that a more fully faceted artifact and acknowledging the players having multiple kinds of experiences. I think we're starting to see it in digital games. But again, we don't have great language.
Yeah. And I will just say that I think Mary's right to call it emergent, but with a hope that we can start to design towards it. And I would say that the designers I see doing it now, I already talked about iterative, right? But like what I tell the students is like, yes, set out with a thing that you want to express, or say an experience that you want the user to have, make a prototype, have people use it. If you're off the mark, start to change things. Make a new prototype that goes hopefully closer to the mark. Change your mark if that's fine, right? But like defining a place to get to and then trying to make things that get you there and regularly finding out how they're doing. But you can't test a person's experience of using a thing without having people use it and watching them use it, right? So games is really on that. But again, like we don't have vocabulary and systems for this, right? And like, again, like other art forms even do things like this. Like I talk a lot about how in theater, right, this is rehearsal. Rehearsal is a room where we get up and we test different performances to see what the audience reaction will be. Now, we don't bring an audience into rehearsal except a couple of times, a dress or something like that. But there's a person whose job it is to sit in the room and pretend to be the audience and say, this is what I felt, and that's goddamn it wrong, or whatever. I think hopefully this is a thing we are really working towards having a more robust ability to do.
Well, it's interesting to hear you each kind of talking about something that's really near and dear to my heart, and that, you know, I do design games for a very particular experience and to make sure that players have a very particular set of emotions, as a result, like that they do have a complex relationship with each other or with power or with their decisions, that they do have experienced a sense of tragedy or a sense of kind of a Pyrrhic victory, in the kind of hollowness in getting everything that they wanted. And I can design for those things. I know at this point, I feel pretty good about like building up these structures for and delivering this experience. But to your point, I have no idea how it works. Like it is a black box, right? I can build the inputs and I can get a predictable set of outputs. But once it goes into the black box, I have no idea how it's working.
Well, that's because one game's system and the vocabulary we might apply to one game is not really reducible very easily to another game. Yes, we have common mechanics things, and yes, we have common elements, but choosing a long game, short game type of strategy for one game is totally different in another game. The set of choices and why one would do that and one's relation to one's neighbor. These things are, I'm sure it can be mapped out, but it's not as formulaic as the kind of ways that you can put people in positions of vulnerability or put people in positions of very big decisions. It's very interesting to think about where we position the players as in the design process, and then how each game becomes its own little universe. It's really difficult to compare these universes.
And they are they're real universes, and they're holistic of everything contained within. So this is why it's also silly to suggest that a game must start at the system or at the content or any of these other things, right? Because like the very ephemeral experiential reaction of the player is a reaction to all of those things connecting each other, right? It's the system and the content you've put in the system and the feelings that are attached to both of those and the feelings that arise when you make that choice and get some of the content as a feedback. I don't know. So yeah.
And one might actually say, well, you know, we could do it in narrative. We have the three-act structure. Mm-hmm. We have Aristotle. We have the denouement, for God's sake. We actually can figure this out, and we can see how you can break it, and that could be a 5-act structure. But I think what's happening is, like, narrative, we often get confused. We think that games are related to visual arts because we look at them. We think that games are related to storytelling because games often have stories. But the thing is, a game is its own art form. It is parallel to those things. And because of that, it incorporates pieces of those things, but it is its own thing. And that own thing makes it a special creature. It makes it something that is about kind of setting up initial guidelines and letting things play out in a way that narrative, the storytelling, even dynamic storytelling, even oral traditions don't do in the same way. Mm-hmm. It's just a very different creature.
Yeah. It's a Dagon.
That's rad. Yeah. So if you wouldn't mind, I would love to talk a little more specifically about the work that all three of you have done. I feel like we did a really great 400 level games discussion, which is really cool. I feel like I understood three quarters of it, which is good for me. Mary, you talked a lot about the experience of a game and what you intend somebody to experience in your game. What's the intended experience of Mechanica? Oh, do your chewing. Don't worry about it.
I'm binge eating M&Ms.
I only wish I was also binge eating M&Ms.
You're doing a Kickstarter. When you have a live Kickstarter campaign, I believe that none of the cholesterol that you eat should count or be absorbed into places you don't want.
Unfortunately, my doctor disagrees.
I don't know what it is, but yeah, in a Kickstarter campaign, we need sugar, but we're at 69,000 right now with 1,288 backers. So I'm pretty much thinking that five or six more M&Ms will push us over to 70K.
That's how it works.
I feel like there's a ratio of M&M intake and participation, but I'm not exactly sure. So Mechanica is a game where Max, my collaborator, and I are really interested in having people feel really smart, being really smart about the use of the materials and the use. There's a lot of these little, it's an open factory floor. It's a little personal to me, too, because I used to actually work in a factory when I was in college. And it was boring, pretty much. Yeah. But, you know, we're good life experience. Feel very lucky to not have to do that forever, though, which is not everyone's choice. Anyway, we have the factory floor here, and we've got like these little improvements that can do different things, that can speed things along on your factory floor. They can duplicate some of your items. They can get things shipping along, so you're shipping more robots to take over the universe and clean up our human mess. There's this sense of, if I build the most clever thing and I can participate, I get the most money. But of course, this is kind of an ironic tone too, because the robots really don't care about money. They use money as a lure. They're like, well, it seems that you people like money, so we will give you it. Until the day in which you, and then they,
right.
And then they're blocked. So there's a little bit of a cute dystopia that we participate in. So maybe there's a little bit of reflection about that too.
I like that.
At least conversation.
Yeah, just what we do to exacerbate our dystopia on a day-to-day level.
I would say further our demise.
Yeah. Yeah.
Willingly have the wool pulled over our eyes.
Yeah.
But it's such comfortable wool.
Yeah.
They're so cute.
They
Luke,
really
I
are.
I can order anything off of Amazon. Anything.
With your magic flat glass device. Yeah, and right. And then you can order a cute robot to map your existence.
I once spent 48 hours trying to buy my sister a cute robot for her birthday before throwing up my hands in despair.
What was the cute robot? Was it like
it was a Roomba? No, she,
oh, it was a Roomba.
Her boyfriend and his two cats just moved in, and she loves the cats, but there's a lot of cat hair in their very tiny Oakland apartment. And I was like, she needs a Roomba. And so then I started trying to find an appropriate Roomba, and it was very hard.
If we get past our next goal of 75,000, there may be a cat in the future.
A cat?
A cat in the...
A cat element.
How can you go into any detail?
No, I cannot.
Oh, okay. I won't push you. I'll just...
75,000.
Eat more M&Ms, and maybe you'll get to 75,000 before the end of the call.
But wait. This is an asynchronous game, Mary. What if this recording comes out after you've reached 75,000?
Ooh. Then I'll have to die and go back in time to re-say this line.
Or you could just say it now and we could, you know, insert it when appropriate.
That's how it works. I'll just cobble together her words in such a way that it'll look like it's an announcement. It'll be good.
Riders in the storm.
This will probably cut out of the podcast. Have you all seen Russian Doll yet?
No.
It's really good, and it's about game design, actually, and like and time travel, and also Natasha Lyonne is in it.
Is it actually about game design?
It kind of is.
The last large set of TV shows that have featured game designers have had absolutely nothing to do with game design.
So
I was awfully suspicious of
game design. Game design, like Run Lola Run was like game design.
That is a very accurate way to put it, I would say. Yeah, and okay. I did love Run Lola Run as well. But like
Run Lola Run is great.
I'm just trying to get us some softer topics after talking about, you know, the dystopia and all that.
One thing I do want to talk about is designing, if I may hijack you.
Please do.
One thing I want to talk about is the design of the team who makes the game. Because for all of the games I've done on Kickstarter, which is now, this is the third game, Visitor in Blackwood Grove, was the second, and my first monarch here. La la la. Monarch, Visitor, and Mechanica, all three we went very searching high and low, searching for women artists and women designers to work on the project, to hire in addition to our own work. So we really prioritize women working on the projects, and it's a women-owned, Resonim is a women-owned company. And I don't think that means that when you play Mechanica, there's somehow this massive feminist mission to, like, although, you know.
If it was, that'd be great.
Yes. It would be great until you actually tried to talk about it at cons, and then no one would talk to you.
If that ain't the way, yeah.
Just saying. But, you know, and things are changing. There's a small group of loyal supporters who really want lots and lots and lots of different games, and it's awesome. But there are a lot of people who don't want to push too many boundaries all at once, and that's okay, too. So it's but for us, our internal process really involves trying to find our artists who represent our vision, who also maybe haven't done a game before and would like to try. So it keeps also the games looking fresh and feeling a little bit different, having a little bit of a different feel than the other games out there. This artist is actually, Anne Sophie's actually an artist in Belgium who's working with us right now. And we just kind of find people on the internet we like and invite them to illustrate our games.
I've never heard of using Pinterest for that reason. That's cool. And I feel like you'd be very focused towards women. That's like an app people who are women usually use. Cool. Luke, I know you mentioned that you had some questions too.
Sam, I wonder if you could, can you talk a little bit about the experience design stuff you've been working on lately?
All of it.
Oh, I believe there was something to do with like a burning cube in New York City. And
what?
Then,
Yeah. I can talk a little bit about some of this, I guess. I went out to New York City and actually went down to the McKittrick, which is where Sleep No More happens. And I worked with a bunch of the actors and staff and crew. Creepy Mask. There it is. Although you covered the best part. The viewers at home aren't looking, so it doesn't matter. We did a short-term installation as a launch of a larger cross-media property, where they were doing essentially a short LARP-like experience or interactive theater experience that was a touch point to a story they were releasing across lots of other media. It was more narrative focused than play focused, but it was very interactive. And in fact, the whole design was around layered spaces that you could interact with, hopefully playfully, people to talk to. But one of the most interesting things about it was, so the people who work at the McKittrick are phenomenally talented, and they are phenomenally talented theater designers. And theater is this special place where we have this vast amount of control over the actual space that we are in, the way that things in it are lit, what we've used to color them, the choice of colors against each other, on and on and on and on and on. And the artists in the McKittrick are incredibly good at this. Whereas the designers of this project I was helping on are Swedish LARP dudes. And Swedish LARP dudes are like, it happens in a wooden cabin by a river. Let us go to a wooden cabin by a river. That's also not a Swedish accent, so I don't really know what was going on there. I apologize.
I think it approximated the Swedish accent experience. You're doing great.
And so we came to this interesting moment where a lot of the stuff the McKittrick made for the event was theatrical. And at 10 feet under the correct lights, it read exactly the way you wanted and delivered the feeling that you wanted. But when you got up and really dealt with it, it left more of a feeling of falseness, honestly, of the theatrical artifice, right? And this went down to the center of the space was to have this giant burned cube monolith in it. So there's this beautiful Japanese woodcrafting technique called yakisogi. Luke, you may be familiar with it. I believe you used it for a bunch of beautiful boxes for a game you made. They burn stuff and it gives this beautiful charred quality and charred scent. Yep. And so we ended up, like, they did a paint treatment and the paint treatment wasn't right. So we pushed the audience back from the cube and piped in the scent of burning wood and had to do all these things to sort of recreate this. But I think a lot of this, and maybe this is what Luke's interested in or not, but like, Mary was right. Games are super unique. First off, the core of what they are is this interaction, likely an interaction loop, although maybe even that is too definitive, right? But so even though they are an art form, they are parallel, not the same as all these other art forms, because this central way in which we engage and consume them is unique and different. And then next to that, they incorporate dozens of other types of art forms and ways of communication and do not have to have all of them or any of them, right? And so this means there are lots of affordances in any given project as to how you're going to deliver information. And that's laying on top of systems that control how you are responding to inputs and how you are delivering information and how you are modifying the core case. And like, as anybody who's studied systems design or case, like, the more things like this that are happening, the harder it is to untangle them and unintersect what you're doing, right? So in the prior example, we pushed everyone away from the box and we added the scent, and that scent, when it's real yakisogi, that scent carries this feeling with it that the designers wanted, this sense of a thing that has been transformed. It's got an aura of death or classic change. It's very powerful. And the exact same smell, but put into the room as you're pushed away at a distance and as you're sort of like clearly being told not to touch this thing, ended up carrying a different feel. Not the one of artifice that we were afraid of and that the other things were having, but an intimidation. The audience started to move further and further away by default from the cube. There is a moment of invitation where they're supposed to come to it, and we needed to use actors to start initiating that because they no longer wanted to go there because of other subtle things we had done to control that space. But there's so many levers here. And that project was really hard because it loaded in, rehearsed, did a test audience in under 48 hours, right? So we discovered this and we open in 6 hours. It's like, well, what the fuck do you do now? You don't have a choice. And so this kind of layered experience design, finding ways to start to map some of the interactions, like Mary was talking about,
right,
gain knowledge, finding ways to test and rehearse, finding some mastery over how conveying different moods and stuff can build into a holistic experience are knowledges we have to get. And it's stuff that super interests me, right? Like, I'm very interested in how we take live experience and start to design it from this knowledge that we've been building now about how we design games. A bunch of interesting people in academic spaces and game design spaces have been reaching back into religion and cultural ceremony as ways to look at the long history of interaction design and look for ways to convey this stuff, particularly because like classical games don't necessarily convey mood and meaning as much as maybe classical ceremonies and rituals do, although I'm not even sure that that's true. I know Mary was showing us a game that's basically Candyland, you said, but that has a very distinct mood and feel to it, right?
Yeah, I mean, the anthropological history of play is a pretty big can of worm to open at the moment, but we could go there if we want to.
No, Trin's face looks so excited, and Luke's face looks so, how much time do we have left?
No. Well, before we go down the anthropology route, I actually just wanted to try to guide this back, why I kind of toss this out there in just relation to some of the other stuff that we're talking about. So you already kind of anticipated my first question, like, is this game design? And well, kind of. But one of the things that really puzzles me about experience design and that really is the scent that pushes me back from it is that it often is a very elaborate method of taking agency away from the player or from the participant. And you can counter it. You can be like, that's fine. But I see in the I see in a lot of these things, like in the very big classic, like Sleep No More, just an utterly, like, it's completely experiential. I don't, like, I have no agency as a player of this game. And so for me, that's a pretty deep chasm between that form of design and game design. All right, go, come at me.
No, I mean, I think you're right, actually. I think that, at least in the sense that a kind of theatrical design gives you agency only in the sense of the kind of things you can focus on. It's almost like you have your own camera in a 3D environment and you get to look at this scene or that scene, but are you really impacting it? Do you have any agency, any player choice that's actually meaningful in that system?
Right.
I think the history of that, that's somewhat a question of volume and scale. When I first did my first trip to see Sleep No More, for example, I had a lot of kind of things that were happening around me. I decided I spent like 5 hours. They didn't kick you out at that time. So I spent like 5 hours in there, basically lost by myself, reading books. So I, yeah. That's a form of agency. We see it in digital gameplay where people choose to not pursue the main quest, but they're still doing, right? And so I was having an experience and there is a choice and it was meaningful to me. I was trying to figure out but then there is a kind of hollowness because some of it is set decoration and you're like, okay, how many of these books do I have to kind of thumb through and just, but there were notes in the books. And so I did start to piece together things. The drawers had far more objects and things they expected people, I think, to take. There were notes given to people that had clues about where certain things would happen. So I think it's a question of scale and economy and, frankly, capitalism, that this kind of experience, as it goes up in price, as it goes up, as the stakes go up in terms of safety, that the interaction and the real choice goes down. So there's a sweet spot, I think, in this kind of design where it can be found, but it's going to be hard to find it in the Disneys. It's going to be hard to find it in these like large scale popular things, but not in smaller interactions.
I sort of agree with what Mary is saying. everything that Mary said is 100% right. However, and Sleep No More, I think, is a really good example. I think to say, like, it's all agency. And the more you design into the margins, the more you design in the margins, the more you can reward different types of agency. And that's where sort of the scale and complexity of having, right? Because then if I choose to go somewhere else, maybe there's something there. However, a lot of agency is illusion anyways. And what you need to do is make the user feel like their choices are impactful, right? Whether or not underneath the hood they're making anything happen kind of doesn't matter as long as they feel like they are. And the best way, I think, to do that is by defining roles for them, right? So this is why I think Sleep No More is so effective. So much of the agency of Sleep No More is about where you look. And the first thing that happens when you go into that show is they give you a mask that A, makes you look, the focus is on the eyes, but it also has this pointy part. You can like almost see the mask in front of you so that you always almost have an arrow showing you where you're going, right? This fundamentally accustoms you to the idea that your choice is about where you go and what you look at. And so then when you go into the piece and make choices about where you go and choices about where you're looking, your choices feel impactful to you, and therefore you feel like you have agency in the piece. And that works, right? So if you scale up and you can design less into the margins or choices are coming about other things, what you have to do is think about what are the roles that I can give a player that allow them to still feel like they have agency inside this experience.
Ooh. Sam is talking about a thing called illusionism, basically this illusion of choice, and which I find anathema. If I was the Pope, I would, you know, issue a papal bull and cast you out.
I think that's a bizarre reaction, Luke. It kind of feels like it was touched on a raw nerve that maybe underneath, you know, it's really true about the existential reality of human existence.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Also, note that Luke is a dungeon master. And illusionism is of the deepest fear to people who run tabletop RPGs of all kinds, because the whole community has this intense interaction around the idea of railroading in a game and of players being able to come and make their own stories, right? So a DM who lets you say whatever you want and somehow puts you back where he wants you all the time, but makes you feel like you made a choice, is someone who is tricking traditional players. And I think that that is a little bit of what Luke is reacting to. Now, Luke, I just put a million words in your mouth, so please spit them out and correct them.
Well, sadly, I'm going to let you have the last word, which is the last time, the first and last time this is going to happen, because we do need to move on. We're actually running out of studio time for Trin. So we have one, we're going to do one more question, or you want to close out, Trin?
Let's do like one really softball question just to like end this and make everybody like a delicious like treat of a question that doesn't have anything to do with anybody's work at all. I'm going to give you guys a scenario and like to hear everybody's personal take on this. This is completely off topic. This is a magical world. You have been bestowed a day, 24 hours, a span of time of 24 hours. The timeline for the rest of the world will not continue while you're having your day. So like you get to have a full day and then go right back to the moment that your day started. Does that make sense?
Wait, is it temporal, like contemporary? Like
it's a tuck in time, so it doesn't affect everybody else. So you actually get a bonus 24.
Yes, you get a pocket universe 24 hours.
All right, but I can't like go back and I'm not transferring time here. Okay.
Can I bring people into it?
I'm going to say yes, you can. If you want to, you can. You can like use it to catch up on your freaking emails, all this stuff. But if you want to like go on an errand, like the bank's not going to be open.
No, I'm going to sleep. I'm going to play games, probably Dungeons and Dragons with my friends. And I'm going to cook a meal I want to eat. Those okay. are the three things I don't get to do anymore. So those are the three things I would like to do.
I have so many more questions. So it resets at the end of the 24 hours?
Yes.
Do I feel the effects of what happened in the 24 hours?
If you chop off your arm will still be missing when you get out of the pocket universe.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. In general, you oughtn't.
So it is 24 hours of permanence.
Right. So wait, what about other people? But other people aren't affected?
Because Sam asked, because I guess I am the magical god of this universe, I have decreed that you can bring other people into your pocket universe if you would like, within reason. So like if you want, go ahead.
But you can bring them in, but they're still affected. It's not like you can bring people in and they don't remember tomorrow.
Right. Like you can't bring them in, cut off their arm, cut off your arm, and then after the 24 hours is up, your arm. Yes. Yeah. No arm trade. The arms trade is forbidden.
Then I would turn off my Slack notifications and work on a game. Given those conditions.
Yeah, that's not bad.
I just want to throw out there as a version of mine, in my mid-20s, every Sunday morning, I woke up, I drove to my friend's house where there were fresh bagels and football. We watched 7 hours of football while eating bagels and deli sandwiches. And when the football ended, we played Dungeons and Dragons for 9 more hours before. Wow. I went home and passed out. I did this every Sunday for years. If only I could have that back. First, for one, I wouldn't do it every Sunday. That would feel bad.
You can do that.
I cannot. I have a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, Mary.
Just there's got to be a way, man.
Put them down for a nap.
I don't have that fantasy, but that's an interesting. It's good to know about you. I'm so glad I know that about you. I think what I would do is use my day to be uncomfortable.
Yeah? On purpose?
Yeah. I would use my day to put myself out of my comfort zone, as long as it's safe, so that I could come back and do my regular things, because I think too often we're all in our comfort zone as we go about our stuff. So not, you know, not exotic things, because I'm not really trying to be a, you know, colonialist, whatever, but just like, you know, even staring at a blank piece of paper for a long period of time is highly uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you said uncomfortable, I was like, she's just going to sit in a really bad chair for a while.
No, I got enough of that. That's kind of everyday life. So that's uncomfortable in a kind of mental way, whether it means if we're used to having things fill up our days, take away all the fill. If we're used to having familiar surroundings, take away the familiar. So I would spend a day very uncomfortably and come back renewed, I think. As long as I'm able to come back.
You are. Yeah, you are. I mean, unless, you know.
Unless they're the arm thing,
The arm thing, no. Again, arms trade is forbidden. I like that your answer was completely different than the other two answers.
What are the things, Luke and I said, what are the things we don't get that we want back? And Mary said, what are the things that I don't get that I would never expect to get? And here is a way that I can have them.
Thank you, all of you, for making the time for being on the podcast. That was really wonderful.
You are super welcome.
This is fun.
I feel like I learned too much about games, and I'm going to have to re-listen to this episode a few more times to let everything sink in. So thank you so much for coming on. Mary, can you give us a quick, my game is Mechanica, and this is what it is, just the...
I'm Mary Flanagan. My new Kickstarter game is Mechanica. And it can be found at mechanicagame.com, at their company resonium.com. And I'm also, my artwork and various other unsundries are found at maryflanagan.com.
Sam, how about you? Who are you and where can you be found on the internet if you want to be found?
I'm Sam Roberts. I currently, if when you're listening to this, you have a chance, have a Kickstarter project running called Football Fantasy, a First and Dungeon Zine. It is part of Zine Quest. And for all of you who remember and love Blood Bowl, it is basically some handy home rules for implementing Blood Bowl-like games inside your tabletop RPGs. I can be found at indiecade.com or games.usc.com, or you can tweet at me at a name that sounds nothing like my name, which is Ashton-esque, A-S-H-T-O-N-E-S-Q. I signed on to Twitter too early and before people had figured out that you should Twitter from a name that's like your name.
I mean, really, just no one should tweet. I mean, that's really...
Right. That's why I haven't made a new account or changed it, because I don't tweet that often. But if you tweet at me, I usually notice. So
this has been I Think You Two Would Get Along, the podcast that comes out of the Kickstarter Games team. Thanks to Matt Connolly for our theme song. Thanks to Alex Cox, our podfather and audio daddy, for running the studio. If you know someone who is thinking about running a Kickstarter, send them a link to this podcast. If you're a new game creator or a veteran and you're interested in being on the show, email me, trin@kickstarter.com. Well, that was nice. It's a square of friendship. Quadrilateral, all equal sides, quadra angle, equidistant, square of friendship.